everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Going for Two, the official podcast of the Extra Points newsletter. I am your intrepid host and publisher of said newsletter, Matt Brown. I am joined, as always, by my co-host of Athlon Sports, Brian Fisher. How's it going, buddy? I understand you just got your second shot.
Yeah, a little stiff from it, but I can't complain. I'm not knocked out like a lot of other folks that have gotten that second shot, but happy to have it coursing through my veins. And I do feel a little Hulk-esque, but between that, you know, the new Ted Lasso trailer dropping for July, I'm doing fantastic today.
I got to admit, I was really hesitant to get into that show, in part because literally every other person in college football media was like, this show is amazing, you should watch it. I'm like, this is based off a commercial. How good could it be? Friends, it is that good. It is worth your time. And that's coming from somebody who is the worst Brazilian in the world because I don't really follow soccer. And it seems like this would be a bad week to not be following soccer because that's the only thing college football Twitter wants to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the news of the day. And I think it's fascinating to see how this has leaked over to certainly a big story over in Europe, but how much it has become a story, the news of the rise and the fall now of the Super League, how it has kind of transposed itself over across the pond here in America. And yeah, part of that is to do with, three owners that are American, three ownership groups that do have the connections here in the shores. But I think it was a great excuse for a lot of people in college athletics to kind of think of themselves. What would happen if that happened with college football? And I think that's why one of our questions even today in our mailbag segment.
Yeah. So you kind of to step back for a second, this episode, we teased this last time. We wanted to get into some of your questions, talk about the things that you're most interested in. And you, just like everybody else in college football internet, is super interested in this Super League concept. And, part of it is, on one hand, I get the interest, right? I've partly built a career chasing esoteric conference realignment rumors. I've been writing about proverbial super conferences in college football since like the 1930s. I have a whole book chapter about the airplane league. You can find some stuff about that everywhere. I might actually pick at it again for extra points these next couple of days. And I understand a lot of the similarities between major European soccer and college football in terms of how it ties into your social identity. And, it's a staple of college football offseason content is to describe various college teams as European teams. But Brian, I know we talked about this a little bit off air. I got to admit, I really don't see the one-to-one comparison about like, oh, a couple of European teams are interested in this. As I understand it right now here on Tuesday afternoon, they're not going to do it anymore. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's the same incentives for college programs to do this. Like we already kind of have a Super League. It's called the Power Five.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to keep in mind the Super League concept is very much akin to the college football playoff. It is not Texas and Ohio State and Florida joining one league and playing their conference schedules like that. I know that's what everybody kind of took off and ran with in terms of bringing this concept to college football. But it's much more akin to the postseason format of the sport being, really just an exclusive group that always gets access. And frankly, there are some parallels in terms of talking about playoff expansion to when you're talking about going to eight teams. Does it include auto bids? Does it include a certain number of group of five spots? Does it include at larges? It's almost a similar concept to that. And I think we actually might get towards that down that road. I know the College Football Playoff Management Committee is meeting this week, actually. I don't expect any news to come out of that, those meetings. But, down the road in the next year or two, you're going to start hearing college football playoff expansion talk. And that's when it kind of comes into overlapping with this Super League concept. But at the end of the day, it's a fun thought exercise. It just does kind of bring you back almost to the summer of 2010 and just jumping on Twitter there and seeing this school might go this way. And this other school is saying no way. And it just kind of brought me a lot of flashbacks to a lot of time spent on Twitter and on the internet and on the phone and on pretty much every form of communication to talk with folks. But it's a fun concept and novel in theory, but I don't think it's coming to not only college athletics, but just the difficulty of implementing in college football with so many different varying groups. I just see it's hard for me to kind of see it coming to fruition on our side of the pond.
Yeah, no, I think that was honestly also part of the appeal of this idea from so many other college journalists, because, you know, the 2010 to 2012 era when everybody was changing leagues, it was a simpler and a stupider time on Twitter and in this sport. And obviously it had some side effects that were negative. You know, we lost some rivalries and travel became a bigger deal, but it was fun. It still is fun. There's a reason that people pay for my newsletters, and I'm trying to track down rumors about the A-Sun or the Missouri Valley. This is a subject that fascinates people. And maybe we can kind of direct the conversation to stuff that actually might happen rather than hypotheticals that we'll save till June. Because look, folks, we got a long off season ahead of us. And I recognize that part of what I do is basically always do off season content, but I don't want to get too ahead of myself here. And if we have to start pulling out the Mount Rushmores and the Super Leagues and the made up conference realignment proposals in late April, it's going to be a long ass summer. I'm not ready for that yet.
No, but you know, I think it is important to kind of keep in mind that it does kind of dovetail a little bit. Coming out of that NCAA tournament, there was renewed, I guess, talk of the Power Five breaking away, of course. And I think there's always been that theory out there that at some point the NCAA and the Power Five, that the major college football programs are just going to separate from each other. And I think it's brought up again this week with the Super League concept. And it's just something, again, I have a hard time seeing, because if the Power Five were to separate from the NCAA, you're still going to have to create an NCAA-like apparatus to govern your rules, govern pretty much everything with when it comes to recruiting and all that. And you know, with NIL, with Alston, with a lot of things coming down the pipe, you know, you're going to keep hearing that talk. I'm telling you, I think we're a long ways from even going down that road. We're not even at the start of that. I still think it's going to be the current status quo. Yeah, there will be tweaks, maybe an expanded playoff here or there, but in terms of these meaningful changes like they're talking about over in Europe, I just don't see it coming across the pond over here.
No, I do not either. Let's get to a couple of these other questions that folks here submitted to us. I had recently written about some actual conference realignment rumors or things that I'm hearing. And one of them was within the Missouri Valley. I had a couple people within the industry say, hey, you know, watch this league to potentially add another member that's outside of the Midwest, that's not in that core geographic area. Look for a team that's going to be in a major metropolitan area and particularly near a major airport. And if you can do that, then the travel costs and both in terms of money and time for all the other teams are really not that big of a deal. Or at least not as big of a deal as you might think. So that means, like, you look at the Missouri Valley, your Evansvilles, your Loyolas, your Illinois States. Think of a school like Denver or Texas Arlington or Oral Roberts, if we want to consider Tulsa some kind of major metropolitan area, you know, something like this, right? So reader Zach Miller, listener Zach Miller asks, so I get why the other schools would want to add an out-of-state area that's near a major airport, but what's in it for the school that's got to fly everywhere? What's in it hypothetically for your Denver or your Arlington or your Little Rock or some other kind of school? And I can tell you here, obviously it's going to depend on the school and the cities and the league involved. But if you are a team that is going by joining a league where you're going to have to fly everywhere, where you're going to potentially make more money from NCAA tournament credits, make more money from media exposure, or raise the profile of your athletic programs, it's worth doing. Especially if a lot of those flights aren't very long. You can move pretty far in this country these days on a flight that's under 2 hours, which is not that big of a lift, like, compared to like a 14-hour bus ride. Would you join a plane league and leave one low major for another low major that's kind of the same? Probably not. But if you can sell it as you're going to be benefiting in other ways, even if you're not getting a gigantic television check, that might be worth it.
Well, I think in particular, basketball would be a big driver of this. You mentioned getting into a better AQ league and just elevating the profile to where you can have more regular teams in the NCAA tournament. Potentially, if you're one of these schools that are near an airport, like Zach is talking about, to where you can get into better competition, you know, raise your profile, raise your net rating, raise your a lot of those things related to the NCAA tournament. Because let's face it, a lot of those mid to lower majors rely on a lot of that revenue that's coming in the form of those units. So I think that's kind of one theory as well. Obviously, you're talking about exposure, just better media deals. Realignment itself is kind of designed to renegotiate those TV deals. So, if you're stuck in a long-term agreement that your conference isn't really producing the amount of revenue that you think it is, maybe this is an opportunity for you to kind of jump at a new league that does offer, that promise of some additional media dollars. And frankly, I think it's kind of lost in it a little bit. It's just fit. Sometimes you're just not quite the greatest fit with some of your conference peers. Maybe you're a religious affiliated university and you want to kind of get back more in league with other schools that kind of share your same values, and or vice versa. I think that's you kind of look back at the Big East and how it was founded, how it's kind of been rejiggered these last couple of years as well. I think that was part of the driving factor, not the only one, but it's certainly one of the issues out there, that just making sure that you're in league with your fellow conference peers. And so I think that kind of comes to mind as well.
That is an enormous point, that when we're talking about realignment right now, anywhere, the television side is generally a much smaller factor, because honestly, outside of the Power Five and maybe the American and maybe like the Big East, your media rights revenue is going to be pretty negligible. Like your actual distribution is going to be six figures and potentially even less than that. The difference between the Sun Belt and the Missouri Valley, or the Missouri Valley and the A-10, or the Big Sky and the WAC or whatever, like it's just not that much money. It's money that you can kind of come up with a myriad of other ways. But institutions want to be seen as peers of similar institutions. That might mean public schools with public schools. And by that, flagships and flagships, regional schools and regional schools, institutions that have similar athletic budgets, that have similar admissions requirements, that have similar missions and similar kinds of students that they're targeting. And that even plays into realignment too, because you also have schools that are looking at out-of-state enrollment strategies. Going back to the Missouri Valley, again, one of the reasons it was told to me that you have schools that are interested in extending outside the footprint is to find more students. This idea that if we are in Colorado, if we're in Tennessee, if we're in Texas, we might be able to increase our brand exposure in markets that export college students, so we can get more people paying that sweet, sweet out-of-state tuition. And depending on the circumstances, the school that's flying everywhere might want to do that same thing, trade students. So all of those things are things you have to consider when evaluating any potential rumor or alignment. It's really not just about what can we do to minimize bus trips and potentially optimize my net rating.
And I think it is also kind of going back to, the realignment days where we were talking about, how good an airport was and what that proximity to campus is. A lot of these schools, I mean, it's just difficult to kind of get your teams across your leagues and around the country. A lot of these schools, even at the Power Five level, can rely on, they're not getting chartered everywhere in terms of that volleyball team. They are taking commercial flights. And so if you're located near a major airport, it's a lot easier to kind of get to some of your conference peers. And so that saves a lot of headaches and frankly is a big issue. I know at certainly those middle and lower tier schools where travel costs are a huge part of the deal in terms of, the money out the door for that athletic department. As much as we want to talk about, scholarships and those conference transfers and inter-school transfers, a lot of it comes down to, you're actually having to pay some of these travel firms to find you flights, to find you buses, to find just ways to connect with your conference peers. And that network has evolved over time, but it can still be difficult if there's not a major airport nearby.
This is otherwise known as the West Virginia problem. There are a couple other schools that are in this boat. That is the most famous example. Speaking of realignment, listener Holden McKee asks, with Eastern Washington and Hartford potentially exploring reclassifying from Division I to other either 2 or 3, will any FBS schools consider the same action? What are the financial considerations from going from a G5 team to an independent? Well, so those are two different questions. I'll answer this. FBS teams considering straight up leaving Division I entirely? No. The only possible school I could think of that might even maybe have that conversation would be Akron or Kent State. Kent State just hired a new athletic director. I believe Akron's still in the process of doing so. They're not anywhere near ready to have that conversation, but like you could at least imagine a world where they might be. The differences at the FBS level, where even a small school is looking at a 25, 30, maybe larger million-dollar athletic department and a low major at half the cost of that, They're not the same sport. I mean, they're not the same thing. You would look at maybe going from FBS to FCS or making changes beyond reclassifying generally. What I can tell you big picture is that I think the Overton window about reclassification across the country is changing. I've been told by some people in this industry that I trust that there are other private schools within the Northeast that are not saying we want to go to Division III. But they're saying we should do a strategic review and let's double check the math and get an idea for what that means, because we should at least think about it. That there are small schools in the Midwest that 20 years ago would have never considered this and are now, it's not a completely unfathomable option. There's major reasons still why you wouldn't want to do it. And Hartford's situation where, you know, candidly, I think the math probably does make sense for them to move to Division III, that math isn't going to work for a lot of other schools. Honestly, you really do have to pop open the hood and look at things like their tuition discount rate and what kind of revenue they're getting from non-scholarship athletes, where they're recruiting students, whether they're over-enrolled or under-enrolled, and what their future trajectory looks like. And that's all stuff that you're not going to be able to look at from just looking at the standings. There's also a pretty big political price to pay for doing that. We're even seeing this at Hartford. We're like, no offense to any Hartford people listening to this, but if that many people cared about this program ahead of time, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And that includes local media. But now that there's a chance that they might reclassify, especially right after they made the NCAA men's tournament, suddenly you're going to get a lot of bad political press. And that means if their regents or their senior administrators leave for a different job or try to leave for a different job, their bio, or when they're being described in another outlet, is so-and-so who led the charge to get Hartford reclassified. That's going in your first beginning of your bio, whether you like it or not. What I can tell you is if Hartford pulls this off and the world doesn't end, and everyone's not blackballed from the higher education industry, then I think somebody at like a Niagara or a St. Peter's or somebody, you know, somewhere in that world will look at this and go, we should think about this a little bit more. Because I can just tell you, like, big picture here, what happened at Idaho. Now, that I honestly think that's going to be the right move in 10 years. But in 5 years, there's nothing that happened to Idaho that's going to make anybody else really excited about reclassifying.
Well, you know, mentioning Idaho, I mean, that is kind of the test case, you know, really for the last couple of years in terms of moving down. But I don't see it. I think it's even harder to do, especially for some of those schools out west that are kind of locked in, because there's just frankly not enough universities around, you know, and you almost have to kind of go along with the pack for a lot of those places. And I think the NCAA is looking at, you know, a lot of these issues. You know, they're looking at reclassification, sports sponsorship issues. Part of that is because of the pandemic. Part of that is because of the financial pressures that a lot of these schools like Hartford are facing. And I wouldn't be shocked if down the road, you know, you kind of can see some of the mixed classification to where, you know, you're already seeing it now with sports. Like, I think bowling comes to mind, where you can have multiple divisions kind of rolled up into one NCAA championship. I think lacrosse is still at that point. There's a couple of others where you don't necessarily have to be a Division I school, but you can still sponsor that sport. And I think that's going to kind of come back in vogue with a lot of these, especially Olympic sports, at some of these schools like Hartford. I would imagine that kind of mixing and matching along with some of these more regional leagues to kind of promote the travel benefits. You know, you kind of see the MPSF, you know, has you know, kind of been kind of the model for that second tier conference, especially out west. To be honest, something like that in a lot of these places for to kind of house those Olympic sports as kind of the bigger conferences kind of shed them, you know, to form more regional leagues, I think could be something that is on the table for a lot of these schools that would make a lot more sense than truly dropping down a full level.
This is something I've been advocating on Extra Points here for a minute, and at the end, simply loosen up some of those rules to do that. If you really kind of dig into what Hartford was telling Carr Sports to consider when they did their reclassification study, and some of the stuff that Hartford's administration has said in public, I look at this and think they really don't want to be Division One anymore. And they may actually have some good reasons for that. They're not really messaging it in the most helpful way, but it can be frustrating when people look at this and go, okay, are we going to see around it and everything? Like, there really are some pretty Hartford specific stuff in terms of where they're recruiting and how Hartford is saying, we're not really generating any money from non-scholarship athletics, which is something that is not true at a lot of other places. There's the second part of that question we'll get into here a little bit later, because we have a few other things here about going independent or moving out of G5 leagues. One other quick thing I want to hit before we turn some time over to our sponsors. Listener Alex asks, if I understand the pre-pandemic NCAA finances correctly, softball is now considered a revenue sport. What other current non-revenue sports do you think could realistically become revenue sports by the end of this upcoming decade? And that touches on something I was kind of alluding to here in the beginning. And for my own style guide, I try not to use the word revenue sports anymore, because honestly, literally every Olympic sports program generates some revenue. You can generate a lot of revenue even if you never sell a single ticket or you sell a single hot dog at a game or anything, because if you're not a headcount sport, all the other people on your roster that aren't getting scholarships are typically paying close to full tuition. It's not uncommon when you really open the hood for a school to make money from their swim or their track team, despite not having any fan monetization whatsoever, just from tuition. A lot of the people that are collegiate swimmers, they're coming from households that are relatively affluent and can afford to pay a higher price. When we look across the country, when you dig into some of these FRS reports, you can find schools that actually generate a fair amount of revenue from their softball programs. Oklahoma, as an example, seven figures. A couple of other schools within the SEC, I imagine at LSU and at Alabama and at Florida, it's a bigger deal out west as well. I don't like to use the revenue side exactly, because that one part, that term colloquially kind of implies that fan generated revenue outpaces expenses. And that, to the best of my knowledge, isn't really true anywhere in softball. It's not true for most sports. It's not true for most baseball programs, for that matter. But if you market it well and you're good at it and you create an experience that fans want to be a part of, absolutely. Beyond just your ability to get tuition and potentially participate in guarantee games, you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars from your television, from your concessions, from your parking, and from your attendance. And I think when you pop open the hood, there are other places that do this beyond the obvious answer of baseball. Hockey, both men's and women's hockey, is already a actual quote unquote revenue sport at several schools that have bigger arenas. It can be at other ones. I think as minor league baseball declines, the revenue potential for both baseball and softball, I think, will go up. The other one that I'm really pretty bullish about, big picture, is volleyball, particularly women's volleyball. We've seen some examples of places like Nebraska that have turned these matches into statewide events. I have been to a Nebraska women's volleyball game. I have seen, 9,000 people pack that arena, and they do the 96 bowls, like walk-up music, and they turn off the lights, and you've got all these like 11-year-old girls waving cell phones, and it's super cool. And I think as more people, one, get to watch these things on television, and as schools begin to really take the live experience seriously, yeah, you can definitely make this a ticketed event and make it a commercially viable product. I am bullish about women's sports generally and about softball and volleyball specifically. What do you think, Brian?
Well, those were the exact ones that I was thinking of, particularly in hockey. I think we're starting to see the investment, especially on the men's side, in terms of arenas, in terms of just facilities. And you're starting to kind of see it. I was reading the other day about how many Canadians were coming down to go through the NCAA ranks to play hockey, just because it's a better experience for them. Obviously, you do add in that academic component to where they can get a degree, proceed through the NCAA system just as normal, because they're being drafted so early that it's a much better and easier path if you want to go to the University of Minnesota or Wisconsin. And just from a lifestyle perspective, then riding that bus on minor league hockey across Alberta or wherever it is. So I think hockey is the big one on the men's side. You mentioned volleyball. I think that's a huge one, especially sand volleyball, which has really kind of come along now. It was for a long time listed as an NCAA emerging sport. I think it's going to be close to kind of tipping over to where it's a full blown sport if it's not already. I don't remember off the top of my head. And the other one I also thought of was gymnastics. Just the way that you start to see some of these programs already. Down in the SEC, Utah in particular has just a gigantic fan base. And when you throw in what's coming with NIL, particularly for those female athletes, I think it's going to be huge, and I think it's going to continue to drive conversation. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it was so tough, 5-10 years ago to even watch a college gymnastics meet. And now between streaming, between television, it's on the Pac-12 network, it's on the SEC network, it's on the ACC network. So I think that has been the different component nowadays for a lot of these sports is it's a television product that you can tune in for. And that changes the game significantly for a lot of these emerging sports. And I think, you mentioned not having to kind of call it revenue, non-revenue. I know back in the day, it was always hard count versus equivalency sport was kind of the dividing line. And that's another thing that I think is going to get examined with the NCAA and a lot of these reviews is, why are we giving 12 scholarships out on a team of 30? When for a lot of these Power Five schools, especially, they can afford it, versus if you can't, you can go to the Division II or Division III route for a lot of these things. So I think that's something that's on the horizon that I think a lot of these schools are going to be dealing with as well.
Yeah, the biggest example for that debate, I feel like, is with baseball, where you have some programs, not just Power Five programs, but mostly Power Five programs that would really like permission to spend more on baseball scholarships and baseball coaches and staffers and build out that infrastructure. Right now, they can't. And you, at the Olympic level, you have a lot of schools that aren't even close to fully funding the scholarships are already allowed to have. Like we essentially do have some Division I teams that are playing Division III for swimming. They're just not giving any scholarships, and they're just playing Division I schedules. And maybe you have to codify it so those aren't actually playing with the rest of the D1 schools. But there is a way for more of these programs to sell more tickets and be a bigger live event experience, I think. And that will continue as it's easier to watch them on television and easier to build a fan base around those events.
And I think it just kind of goes back to how unique college athletics is in this country. When we talk about volleyball, when we talk about some of these other sports that we were just mentioning, if you're in other countries, a lot of that is under the purview of some national sporting organization or event. And while that's somewhat the case here, just the Olympic movement itself is much more divorced from the actual operations. Certainly, there's congressional charters and all that, but it is just such a unique setup. In college athletics, and we have a not only a ton of people in there, thousands and thousands of schools. So I think it is important to kind of keep in mind when we are talking about a lot of these sports, this is such a unique endeavor compared to everywhere else around the country. And frankly, it's a big reason why when we go to the Olympics, America does really well in those medal counts because of this system and feeding up. And I think we're really going to continue to see refinement in terms of how things operate and ultimately the growth from some of these emerging sports as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern among both athletic directors and some involved with the U.S. Olympic committees about how sustainable that model is as some of these Olympic sports programs get dropped. That's probably a podcast and a newsletter for another day. We have a couple other mostly financially related questions I want to dig into, which I think now is a good time for us to talk real quick about a couple of sponsors that help give us money so we can talk about how athletic departments get some money. One of those is Proper Good, which is a sponsor that I'm glad to be working with right now because it ties into what's been a particularly big challenge for me and our family over these past couple of months. As we're slowly starting to emerge from our quarantine chrysalis back into what we would consider regular society, all of our routines have been completely blown to hell. And a big part of that has been food, right? My eating schedule is not the same as it was. My cooking schedule certainly isn't when I go to the grocery store. And, I've been finally going back to the gym. I'm trying to get a little bit healthier. My own health goals have changed a little bit. And sometimes it would be nice to have something that would, a way to make that food preparation and delivery that meets my goals easier without me having to think about it here so much. And that's what Proper Good is. These guys make the tastiest and healthiest zero prep meals that you can want. They're made with ultra clean and functional ingredients, not any of the stuff that has a hyphen and has 40 characters and you can't really pronounce it. There's no added sugar, and they're ready to eat in just 90 seconds. You don't have to store it in the fridge. So you can just, or have to deal with any complicated food storage situations. You just enjoy it at home. When you're at work, when work was the place that we went to, you pop the top off, stick it in the microwave, you're good to go. They also have options for a bunch of other food, various diets or plans that you might have. If you want to go plant-based, you're doing keto, you want to go gluten-free, you want to go dairy-free, they have options for you. Lunches, dinners, whatever else that you need. Find out more at eatpropergood.com. And for a new sign up, you can get 10% off your first order. I also want to point out that this podcast is a product of Extra Points. We've got a bunch of big changes happening at Extra Points right now. I'm really excited about them. We're transitioning. Don't tell anybody. It's a little secret. We're transitioning to a new website where we can have some static document hosting and a couple of other additional features plugged in there, which I think will help make this podcast better and also the future of that newsletter better. If you like talking about this kind of stuff, if you're curious about college athletic department financials, about smaller league realignment, about how business operations and how everything all fits together for an athletic department. You like listening to this 45-minute a week conversation. By God, you are going to love Extra Points because that publishes 4 days a week and digs into the exact same stuff, and you can read it instead of just having me kind of talk it at you. You can become a paid subscriber right now and get 20% off, which gives you 4 of these episodes these newsletters every week, plus access to our paid Discord channel where you can talk with Extra Points readers about whatever else is on your mind and holler at me. You can get all those at extrapointsmb.com/go42. That gets you 20% off your paid subscription. That means you can get a whole year of these things for under $60. That's a hell of a deal. That's basically like getting the equivalent of 3 books over the course of a year about how college athletic works. That's extrapointsmb.com/GOFOR2, 20% off. A couple more questions here I want to be able to get into. My buddy Lolo asked, I think a really pretty insightful one. Says, pretend you're an athletic director here. If you had to go down each of the current conferences and pick out a team from each league to succeed as an FBS independent, what school would you want to pick? And this is an interesting question, I think, because the criteria that you'd use would be different from league to league. I don't think you automatically pick the best football school or the best athletic school in each particular conference. So I figured, hey, why don't we sit down here? Let's go through a couple of these and let's see if we're on the same page. We can start here in my neck of the woods because I took this question in the Big Ten. I think if you're trying to pick what's a team that's going to be the most successful commercially, athletically, et cetera, as an independent, you could probably pick a couple of them that would work out pretty well, but you really can't go wrong with my alma mater, the Ohio State Buckeyes, right? Literal, maybe the national athletic brand. You sponsor literally every sport, so you can fit into all different varieties of other Olympic sports programming. You won't have a problem selling a TV package, and you should have no problems getting any games that you can actually win. Am I off base here?
No, that was literally my first thought. And so maybe that's why we're doing a podcast together, is we think so much alike. But, I think the other thing that when after thinking of the Buckeyes, first and foremost, for all the reasons you just listed, I mean, just the location, the facilities, the broad-based athletic department. I also kind of gave some thought to Michigan, certainly from an academic standpoint, they think a little bit differently than the Buckeyes do. And so I think if anybody kind of wanted to really push that nuclear button, it would almost be the Wolverines. Truth be told, they would love to be playing some of the Ivy League schools in a lot of different sports. It would be tough to cobble together the football component. But if there's any, really school that can kind of travel the country and still get the massive crowds, it would probably be the Wolverines as well. So I think those are the easy two out of the Big Ten is Michigan and Ohio State, to nobody's surprise.
Yeah, I don't disagree about Michigan either. I think that would work. work, and you could even sell that to some of your fans. Like, yeah, sure, we'll play Michigan. We'll play Ohio State every year in every sport. That shouldn't be a problem. But really, we wanted to go play other World War II historical powers and really spend some more time with Cornell. And that would be a very Michigan man thing to do. The Big 12, I hate to kind of be super basic, but I mean, perhaps more so than any other power league and team in the country, it's got to be Texas, right? You already have your own dang TV channel. You have, it's a similar argument to Ohio State. Texas's alumni base maybe isn't quite as national as Ohio State's is, but it's probably pretty close. But in terms of the infrastructure needed to be successful, they have it more than almost anybody, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about certainly one of the biggest programs, not only in the state of Texas, which supports a lot of other colleges to where they can play with them. But I just think they make a lot of money for a reason. And all these ingredients are there really to go independent tomorrow. And I'm sure once the Big 12 grant of rights comes up and that new media deal, you're going to start to hear rumors, however far-fetched that they are, that, you know, Texas is kind of considering, you know, maybe they want to do the independent route. And, you know, to any school that out there that could do it, I think Texas is certainly ready to go. It's almost a turnkey property in terms of that name recognition. You know, you're talking about being able to not only play the in-state teams, but I think that is a program that can go around, whether it's football or basketball. You know, they can go to the West Coast and they would like it. And I think geographically, it just makes a lot of sense too, you know, to where you're really never more than 2.5-3 hours away from pretty much anybody that you want to play. And, you know, being right there in Austin, it's a city that I think a lot of programs would like to go into. And so you're already seeing it a little bit as well with, you know, Austin FC. The MLS team is there now in the city. They've got an F1 race there. So I think it's a growing in importance, just that town. And I think the carryover to that would be certainly the ease of use that, you know, Texas could be on going out there. And frankly, I think they would have less ties to other universities if they wanted to do it. Like I always imagine Oklahoma being in the same conversation with Texas, except when it comes to this part, because I think Oklahoma is tied so closely to Oklahoma State in that, and just from a political and educational perspective, you know, I get less of a sense that Texas is truly tethered to not only Texas A&M, as we've seen with them leaving the Big 12 years ago, but, you know, Texas Tech. These are all multiple university systems. And so I think Texas, more than anyone else, can really kind of pull that ripcord quickly.
Those are, I think, the two most obvious ones. But when you get to some of the other leagues, it gets a little bit more complicated. I was thinking about the ACC here, and I'm not sure there's an automatic, obvious, like clearly obvious answer. Before I give mine, what would you think for the ACC program that might be best equipped to go independent?
Well, I mean, I think you could almost add Florida State in there because they've been a previous independent for years and years and years before even joining the ACC. But to my first thought was also Georgia Tech. You're located in Atlanta. You know, you do have a unique fan base and an alumni network that I think could make it work. I'm not saying it's the greatest opportunity for them to go independent, but I think just where they're located, you know, how that school is positioned, you know, I think they could be kind of one of the easy test cases to kind of do it. But that it is tough, you know, to find the right one in the ACC. But those are kind of my two. Would be Florida State and Georgia Tech.
Yeah, there's several teams in this league that have long histories of being independent at one point or another, and those make sense. My initial thought was Miami for somewhat similar reasons. Miami is this weird case of the private school, right, where you're in this very important, talent rich, TV market rich area. But that's not where a lot of your actual students and grads live. Like Miami's actual like student base is still pretty heavily Northeastern, which is part of what makes the ACC an attractive entity for them, because it gives them exposure in places like New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts, where a lot of the people that end up going to Miami go and where their graduates end up going. So that kind of full coastal exposure might allow, you know, give them a different kind of financial and television flexibility to function as an independent. Anybody school that's located in anywhere in the South or on the Eastern Seaboard is not going to have trouble finding geographically nearby games. Neither, you know, Florida State and Miami, neither of them had any trouble scheduling anybody before they actually joined this league. I think Florida State would be fine too. The tricky thing about both the Florida schools and Tech, for maybe some different reasons, is they are secretly not nearly as rich as a fan might think that they might be, given all of the success that they've enjoyed on the field, right? Florida State was a teacher's college not that long ago. Their struggles with fundraising, I think, have been pretty well documented, given that that's a reason why they suck right now. Miami also in a similar situation, where over the years, they've been much better at sports than maybe their administration wanted them to be, or planned for them to be, or had fundraised for them to be. So both of those, nobody in this league, even your Duke or North Carolina, is a plug and play success, perhaps like Texas or Ohio State might be. We'll go through the rest of these here really quickly. The American, I'd pick Tulane. Not even close to the best athletic program in this country, but you could fill out an entire schedule for almost everything within a bus ride. You're a great academic institution. You've been independent before, you have a little bit more fans than maybe a couple of the other commuter colleges might have that are more geographically dispersed.
I agree, but I think obviously Navy, being a former independent, would have been my answer. You know, that was kind of what I was going with, but maybe that was almost glaringly obvious. I was also thinking, it's funny because I know some UCF fans would love to kind of say, well, we're good enough and big enough to kind of go independent. And I don't think that's the case at all. I also think that that's another university that's kind of tied, as much as they don't want to hear it, to UCF and some of their other regional peers. So I do have trouble thinking of some of the AAC schools, but I would also kind of throw out SMU there, another school that is located in a major metro area in a state with a ton of other programs around it. It's a private school. I think it's definitely occupies a bit of a unique position. Kind of in the hierarchy of the sport, and I think it wouldn't be as successful as certainly we've seen Navy or some of those other schools be. But I would almost put SMU as potentially out there as well.
For Conference USA, and this I may have even written this before in on Extra Points. There's an obvious choice here for me, UTEP. And it's not because UTEP's good. In fact, UTEP is pretty bad at a lot of things. But I look at them as following a model pretty similar to New Mexico State, where you're spending a lot of money on traveling. And if you, say, stopped playing some of these Alabama schools, where you don't get a ton of players anyway, and use that schedule space to schedule some more body bag games, you sell your local television rights to Flow for $300,000 a year, and just be as local as possible, and let yourself get clobbered three times a year, I think you're going to come out financially ahead. Then you are chasing a league championship you're probably never going to actually get. And if you are a really bottom of the barrel G5 team, I really do think that's something worth considering if you could find a place to put your basketball program. That is where, Tulane and Navy, those are fun thought experiments. I really think UTEP should call a meeting for this,
Yeah, I mean, you could even look at potentially, landing some of those other sports with the WAC, reconstructed, or even kind of dropping down a level to go as an FCS independent if you're UTEP. And I think it's going to be interesting to see. We've already heard these rumors about UT Rio Grande Valley potentially starting a football program, some of the others kind of in that area. Maybe that makes it a little bit more likely that you can kind of go your own route, because it would be certainly make a lot more sense if that is much more of a regional school than playing that kind of broad area of Conference USA.
I have absolutely no idea who I'd pick for the MAC, because mostly I think these schools are structurally very similar. Maybe Toledo, but if any of you feel really passionate, you can tweet me at Matt Brown EP. Brian, is there any that overwhelmingly jumps out to you?
Maybe NIU, just from the history of success that football program has had, but you're all right. There's a reason the MAC is as a league, probably the most similar in terms of the peer institutions. And that does make it a little bit hard. Maybe Ohio out, but I just don't see really anybody else inside the MAC. This is a league full of good fits, and that's kind of why.
Yeah, this is not a pejorative. That's a homogenous league. The Mountain West, I think you got to go with the troops again, right? You take Air Force, recruits nationally, national brand, has football coaches that have not so secretly insinuated they don't really want to be in the Mountain West anyway. If you want to pick Hawaii, I'm not going to complain too heavily, but I don't think Air Force would struggle for money, exposure, or ability to get games if they went independent.
Yeah, I mean, Air Force, Hawaii, you mentioned, I think the obvious answer as well that you can kind of throw out there is Boise State, because I think a lot of those Broncos fans have clamored for that, you know, especially with, given the friction and frustration at times with the Mountain West as a league. So I think that is out there. And I think, frankly, having BYU almost become a regional partner these last couple of years with the way they've scheduled games and really kind of developed that rivalry, maybe that makes it a little bit easier for Boise State to kind of go out on their own. But, you know, I spoke about it earlier. It's tough if you're one of these West Coast programs because, you know, frankly, you know, you're still traveling just a long ways to kind of find peer institutions. And when you're talking about getting into November and December when travel is already difficult enough in some of those mountain regions, going independent is certainly an issue that is fraught with a lot of issues that would face a team like Boise State.
Yeah. If Boise was able to get a couple more Power Five teams to come to campus, I think they could get a television deal that's not that much worse than BYU. And that's something that probably nobody else at the G5 level could really assemble. Maybe somebody in the American. Within the Pac-12, I think I've literally written multiple times that this is something that USC not only could actually pull off, but they should legitimately take some meetings on. You could probably say the same thing about UCLA. Just say everything that's true about USC, make it 15% worse. Now that Oregon has become a much more national brand than it was in like 1995, that you could potentially argue that as well. I'm assuming you wouldn't want to argue for anybody outside of that group.
No, I would push back a little bit on UCLA because they're so tied to Cal and the entire system there that I think that would be imminently difficult if you know, it's a tandem package between Cal and UCLA. And I think with Cal in particular, they're tied a little bit with their Bay Area rivals in Stanford. I think Stanford and USC being the two private institutions could do it. I think the Cardinal in particular, seeing how, you know, that they've kind of built the brand as a national university, would look into it. But the easy answer and obvious one is USC. They have the prestige. I think they would be able to command a pretty good sized television deal. You know, when you're talking about going out on your own, it's all about getting eyeballs. And there's one major university on the West Coast that can really draw in, you know, especially when you're talking about some of those mid-tier games that you're going to have to televise if you're ESPN or Fox. USC is the obvious answer. Plus, you know, located in USC, and that school, let's face it, they are not hurting for money. So, you know, kind of with Notre Dame's decision to go independent and maybe take a little bit less, I think you could kind of make the case that USC can kind of have some similar thoughts in terms of that independence.
And hey, I got to think NBC would probably be interested in packaging some of those rights there with NBC. That's you know, exactly. I could go 2,000 words on that and have before. This is running a little bit long, so we'll wrap up here. The SEC, I think probably argue for probably four or five other programs. I think I'll go a little bit different here and stump for Florida, just because I think that their geographic distribution of some of their fans is a little bit wider than maybe Alabama is, and their ties to some television areas might be a little bit wider. But let's face it, if Florida, Georgia, LSU, or Alabama wanted to do this, I'm sure they could pull it off and be just fine.
The only thing that I thought of with the SEC is that some of these schools you mentioned, Florida, I think they're, again, so closely tied with Georgia, some of the others in that league. It's difficult to kind of imagine. I think if there's anybody that would not only seek it out, but kind of get the blessing of all the 13 other members, it would probably be Vanderbilt, just because they're such an odd fit for the league in general. So that came to mind first and foremost was Vandy, just from, you know, a fit standpoint. But we'll see. I don't think there's anybody else in the SEC that really kind of qualifies, because it's such a tight-knit league, to be honest.
We'll wrap up here with the Sun Belt. There, I would probably argue for Monroe for the same reason I argued for UTEP. Your school is broke. You are spending way less than any other FBS institution. You're not really competitive in the Sun Belt right now. Go independent. Play all your games via bus and take your body bags, and you'll come out ahead than where you are right now, I think.
That would be my selection as well. Although I think, you know, Georgia State, you know, being in Atlanta, that might give them a bit of an edge. You know, certainly the new stadium, the new facilities, certainly there's some old rivalries that they have regionally that can make a lot of sense as well. So that's the only other one that I could maybe think of out of the Sun Belt. But you're right with Monroe. That is the one that kind of came to mind with the Sun Belt.
I mean, at that level, regardless of where you're located, like, Georgia State doesn't have enough fans. A Georgia State specific television package. I don't even know if that would give them $400,000 a year, unless you're bribing people to come to Atlanta to play you. Let's get out here on this one. And this is a question that pops up sometimes in mailbags. And Brian, I think you might be better equipped to answer. KC Masterman asks us, what are your top 10 places to eat around the college football world? And it's harder for me because for large stints of my career, I just didn't travel all that much. I can tell you some places that have really good press box food or places that I visited outside of being a college football reporter. But maybe you have more stronger opinions about places that folks absolutely have to go to eat.
Well, I'm certainly no Andy Staples. I'll put that up front. Andy takes things to a whole new level. When you go out to eat with the Athletic's Andy Staples, I mean, that is a treat for itself. But, you know, when I first saw the question, I immediately kind of thought of Clemson and the Smoking Pig, which is a great barbecue place there. You know, it's difficult for a lot of these places because, you know, if you're going to, say, Oregon State, you're probably going to come into Portland and you know, kind of drive down either the day of the game or drive in early. So, as much as you want to stop by Pock Pock, you know, it can kind of be difficult just to kind of find the time, especially in some of these tight schedules. Archibald's going to Alabama. I always try to stop by there. Baylor, the check stop, which has kolaches. Fantastic. It's right there off the highway. Anytime you got to go from Austin to Dallas, I got to end up stopping there. Speaking of Austin, you know, Franklin's Barbecue, I think that's the top spot to me in the city. I know some others might want to argue that you got to kind of go out of your way to go to Lockhart, and I certainly understand that. But when you're kind of staying closer to the city, I would lean towards Franklin. Dallas is difficult because it's also home for me. You know, the Pecan Lodge is certainly an old favorite. Fuel City Tacos was a place that, you know, I remember from high school that, you know, it's a gas station in South Dallas, which is never the most appealing thing if you're going to TCU or SMU or whatnot, but it's definitely worth kind of going out of your way to go get. I'm trying to think of some others. Certainly Indianapolis, St. Elmo's is kind of the favorite for college athletic spots. NFL draft and the combine, you know, a lot of people stop by there, or Harry and Izzy's, you know, I think is the other thing that the real vets know. So that would be one. Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. You might have some opinions on that.
No, I mean, look, Zingerman's is great. It's a little expensive, but it's a little pretentious, which makes it a very Michigan man kind of place, but it's a great sandwich. It's a great little grocery store. I would not tell people to. I mean, if you're in town, you should go to Zingerman's.
That was the one thing I thought of in Ann Arbor, Salt Lake City, Mucci's, some great meatballs, meatball subs there, and the Red Iguana, I think has to be mentioned as kind of the Mexican food place, especially because it's kind of on the way towards the airport. So those are the spots that came to mind. I think you could sit here all day. You know, it's difficult too because you know I live in Los Angeles, so there's some great places here that I could talk about, but not really true college town. But those are some of the spots that kind of came to mind. And I mean, New Orleans, it's difficult to narrow it down to just one place, you know, whether it's, you know, Rufino's, Cafe du Monde, you know, whatever it might be, Baton Rouge, you know, you're tailgating. So whatever the food is out in the parking lot, there's a lot of great places, you know, around the country. And that's one of the joys, I think, of covering college athletics is visiting a lot of these towns, whether they're college towns or big cities, and finding some of those great spots to eat just makes it a little bit sweeter. You know, when you do find that one place that you've been told to go to and it lives up to the hype.
There are two things that I'll add. I spent a lot of time in Greenville, North Carolina, but I've covered several games there. My mom used to teach there. I've been to almost every major barbecue place there. I really like Bees. I like Carolina barbecue. It is, I think Greenville is kind of an underrated place, especially in that league where almost everything else is a big city. And I'll just say this, like, best press box food I've ever had was at Rutgers. I would go back, and cover another game. The game I was covering then was a complete laugher. It was an OSU Rutgers game. OSU won by 50 or something, and you know it's over by midway to the second quarter. This was definitely not a 7-Eleven Rollers kind of press box setup there. It was better than a lot of restaurants that I've been to, and I've heard that from other people that have covered games there. So if you get a chance, if you're in this line of work to cover a Rutgers game, I definitely recommend it. It was definitely better than anything I had anywhere near campus, I think.
I have not been to Rutgers, so I can't speak to the press box food there. The one in terms of press box foods that comes to mind is Notre Dame. Just the spread there is top notch, especially, you know, thinking back to like my first time, you know, going to South Bend, you know, as a student and covering a team there and just being like, wow, this is some legitimate press box food. This is not hot dogs and salad. This is some nice eats, and you know there was pizza after the game, so that comes to mind. Oregon's always got a great spread too up there, but nobody is going to be taking some sports writer's opinion on press box food because it's still nothing like some of those restaurants that we were just mentioning earlier.
No, you should. I guess unless you're at Rutgers, you should go eat someplace that's not a press box. And listen. I'm a 34-year-old man, and I live in an absolutely great food city here in Chicago. And I still sometimes go to 7-Eleven. Don't tell my wife, clearly my food opinions are terrible because I will still willingly eat garbage. I'm sure wonderful food is great. I enjoy that too, but I'll still eat a 7-Eleven hot dog. With that, I think we've covered just about everything here. We have some exciting stuff coming down. In a few weeks, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe for free. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. If you like it, if you were to leave us a positive review on Apple or anywhere else you get your podcast, that helps more people find it. Speaking of finding things, Brian, where can people find you?
Brian D. Fisher, BryanDFisher on Twitter is always the best place. A little bit more heavy on the NFL side and the lead up to the NFL draft right now, but I'm going to get right back on college athletics, especially as we've got some spring games going on. It just kind of feels like the calendar is turning and a lot of some NCAA sports still to come.
Yeah, the calendar doesn't feel like it's turning for me because as we're talking right now, even though it's late April, it is literally snowing. God is dead. Climate change is dead. I don't know why I live here sometimes. No, you can find me at Matt Brown EP. I'm at matt@extrapointsmb.com. Find me at Extra Points. It's a newsletter or this podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch up with you again soon.